It's like, so in Cook County, they're counting niggas by the pound. At the White House, they're counting niggas by the cell. Cool.
And then going to our schools and counting niggas by the pound. Everything goes back to desire. In my own life, I'm interested in continuously figuring out what it looks like to understand these structures beyond the theoretical, which means that I'm also always figuring out how I can move closer, or rather, how I can move further away from the hegemonic desire that we're socialized into, right? Like, who am I desiring and why?
What the fuck is up, y'all? You're listening to Abolition-ish, a black politics and culture podcast at the end of the world, or so they say. These episodes are recorded live and virtually from Mexico City, Mexico, and I am humbled to be your host. My name is John Moore, and you can follow me on Twitter at incivility. That's incivilitea. The Abolitionish podcast is produced by Wiley, and you can follow them on Twitter at WHOSWYLEE. That's Who's Wiley. I am so excited to be back with y'all for another episode of season 3. Today, I have the honor to be joined by writer and editor, Deshaun L. Harrison. As we kick it, we're going to talk about anti-fatness and anti-blackness, what it means to write for black audiences, and so, so much more. So, sit back, kick your feet up, and enjoy the ride. And remember, you can follow us on Twitter at abolitionish. You can follow us on Instagram at abolitionishpod. That's abolitionish, P-O-D. And you can become a monthly supporter of this work by becoming a patron at patreon.com/abolitionish. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll catch you on the other side of something better. All right. So, yeah. 2022 Transgender Nonfiction Lambda Literary Award finalist. Belly of the Beast, The Politics of Anti-Fatness as Anti-Blackness. Hi, Deshaun. How are you?
Hello, friend. I'm happy to be sharing space with you in this moment. Thank you for inviting me on. You know, it only took 3 seasons, but it's okay.
You know, I hate you. It's true.
No, it's giving.
Yeah, it's funny. I was telling Wiley at the beginning of the season, like, how I needed to bring more folks on that I didn't know in real life, or, you know, like, didn't know at all. But I was like, to do that, there are some people we have to bring on first, because these are people I've been meaning to bring on that we haven't talked to yet. So, you know, so I'm like, exactly. I'm so happy and excited to talk to you about your work, about what's going on in your mind, about what's going on in the world. Maybe I can start by talking a bit about, well, so it's true. I do want to start with an image from The Beast. And I'll try my best to bring our readers up to speed for folks who haven't read the book or might not be familiar with your writing and your work. But obviously you can do a better job of that than me. But at the same time, I don't want you to feel like you gotta do the whole, like, you know,
yeah,
sentence by sentence, blow by blow. Like, that's not, you don't gotta do all that. Because they need to go read the fucking book. You know, if they want the whole shebang, like, you know, that's what
her.
The book is for. And something I feel like, you know, purchase her. She's waiting. I feel like something we'll talk about also is just like why I want folks to read the book. I feel like it's a book really thoughtfully written for a whole range of different readers and Black audiences. And you know, I feel like that's even more, you know, it's one thing to be like, hey, like you wrote this 500-page treatise on bullshit. Please summarize it for our readers so they don't have to bog through the shit. But that is not how I feel about Belly of the Beast, Ja. I don't feel like I'm sending you to your doom when I'm asking you to open it. Which really, you know, it's really, that's not the book experience you always get.
That's
So,
true.
okay. Yeah, for sure. All right. So very quickly, you know, I think the title alone is something that really cued me into where you were and talking about fatness and blackness. Because it's not Belly of the Beast, the politics of anti-fatness and anti-blackness. It's not one of those like, you know, abstract titles that's like Belly of the Beast, Belly, Body, and Violence. You know, it's like, no, nigga. I'ma just give you the argument right here, right
Right
now.
here, yes.
And I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that because I feel like, you know, there's often this disjointedness, but like, I don't know. There's like this idea of like, oh, like if I wanna make a beautiful argument, I can't be direct. And that's just so tired, I feel. Especially when it comes to anti-blackness, like
Yes.
really? And I say that as a nigga who's always turning verbs into nouns and nouns into verbs, and like I'm not, you know, shitting on the poetic niggas. I'm just being like, oh, like how refreshing that like you don't hide the fucking argument at the end or some shit. Like from the very
Take the
beginning, the stakes
argument.
are there. You know, like we're gonna start with the stakes, because why would we start with anything else?
Yes.
So the abridged version of that, right, is like that is the stakes, y'all. Like anti-fatness as anti-blackness. And Deshawn really inviting us to think about not just, you know, this kind of like, how do I put it? Like, I feel like the argument of this book, right, is not that anti-fatness and anti-blackness are related or intimate in the way that like that kind of abstract roundaway thinking wants to just like say things like, you know, like abolition and democracy are related and intimate. And it's
Right.
like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like,
Are you
yes,
sure?
but huh? You know, like by what do you mean by intimate? Do you mean these things are antagonistic? Do you mean that these things are complementary? You mean that these things are opposed? Because those are all different forms of intimacy, right? Like, so what's actually going on? So this idea, right, that anti-blackness is a constitutive, the constitutive thing that moves anti-fatness, and that that's not something that can that we can allow to fall out of the discourse. Likewise, if we have a conception of anti-blackness that doesn't start with the body, that doesn't start with accumulation, and really quite clearly, if we don't have a if we're not thinking of anti-blackness as something that is not just political but also libidinal, or not just, you know, electoral, but also, you know, about desire and about beauty and about ugliness and about what moves someone to want to be in the world in a certain way, then you're also kind of lacking. And so, yeah, and I feel like we'll, you know, in the course of our conversation, hit on some of the key sort of moves that you make in the text. But I just wanted to sort of do that to sort of set us up very quickly. And then I really wanted to start off with this image, because it was an image that really stuck out to me. I'm in this poetry, this like year-long poetry class, and one of the things that's making me realize is that I'm not really great at observation, like when it comes to writing things down. A lot of my specific observations are in my head, but for whatever reason, they really never make it to the page. And so I feel like that's sometimes why I turn to the abstract, you know, because I'm like, oh, well, I'm sure there's a more beautiful, simple way to say this, but I'm gonna just
Yes.
give you a bunch of syllables. And there's this one image on page, shit, my little, what is it? My little ebook version was 28. But it's
Okay.
in the sort of quasi beginning of the book. And Deshaun is talking to us about basically introducing this argument that to be fat and black is to not be in possession of yourself in a certain way. That indicts, right, how we as black people think about the bodies of other black people, the being of other black people. And so I'll just read the quote, and then I would love for you to talk about how this image came to you and sort of like the work that you think it's doing in the book. So this quote is as follows, quote, "We deify the imagery of our grandmothers cooking, cleaning, and caring for us with their low-hanging arm fat." And then a few lines later, Deshaun says, quote, "Ingrained in the DNA of the Black South is the belief that fatness, especially when it rests on a Black woman, belongs to non-fat people." End quote. And so I just really, I never heard that sort of maybe at all, but certainly not voiced in that way, because you're not just talking about a kind of misogynistic or patriarchal possession of like a black woman's body or like a sense of entitlement. You're speaking specifically to like what a black person sees in the Black South, what a black person sees when there's a grandmother or a black woman providing care that is fat, what they see in her, what she means to them. And this like sense of possession I found really jarring, but also really clarifying, because I'm like, yeah, that, yeah. And I was thinking immediately of like some of the, just like memes about around Thanksgiving, it's like, just like images of like black women's low-hanging arm fat, right? And it's like, oh, that play about to be, woo, that play about to be crazy, right? And it's like, okay, but that's not all of the metaphor. There's there's like an ellipsis, and I think that, that passage I just read is a real beautiful and sharp gesture towards that ellipsis, which is to say, like, okay, why? Why do you trust that this work is so made for you? So I would just love for you to talk about that image if you like.
No, so first of all, this is why I've been waiting to get on here because I knew that we would have a conversation that I have not had with anyone else in any of my other interviews, and we're starting off with a banger. Because no one else has brought this up, but this is like, for me, that entire part of that first chapter, I believe, or maybe it's the second chapter, is very important, I think, because it forces us to really talk about and interrogate more deeply like our relationship to the women in our lives that we say that we value, but also the people whose bodies emulate those women when if they're not actually women, right? And the ways that massage noir then is something that is much deeper than just the sort of base understanding that we've been offered in this like pop sociology course that we get on Tumblr and Twitter, that it just solely affects black cis black women in particular. And so what I'm writing there is like, what does it look like for us to only value the relationships we have with our matriarchs if their value is only as deep as their service to us, right? Like, what does it mean for us to then believe that we possess them because, or that their only value is in our possession of them because of what they're able to provide for us? And how is that not the exact same like sort of foundation for the construction of the mammy archetype, right? Like, what is the difference between that and the mammification of Black women, fat Black women in particular, besides the fact that you have no structural power as a slave master? And I think that, like, that is something that is really significant and really important to talk about, because I don't think we often think about that in that way, right? Like you said, when Thanksgiving comes around, the memes come flying. Everyone's talking about how their grandma gonna be in the kitchen and auntie gonna be in the kitchen and all of that. And we don't really think more deeply about the ramifications of that understanding of their bodies and what it really says about them as mammy, as maid, as service or server. And I think that then says that we don't think beyond that to realize that there is something much more harmful that goes, that if we can get there, that's just the surface of just how harmful this idea is, right? Because now what we have to then think more deeply about is how much we are willing to think about their bodies and bodies that look like theirs as things that are deserving of being taken advantage of sexually or monetarily or emotionally, because there's no value beyond how much we're able to possess them. And I just think that that's just such a important thing to think about with regards to our bodies and how our bodies are engaged. And the sort of deeper context of that was thinking about my body in particular and bodies like mine on people who are socialized as boys and are therefore engaged in the ways that we are, because we have bodies that sort of emulate those that we think are deserving of being possessed, while also being understood that, like, we are raised to understand that our responsibility is to exist solely as people who are invested in maintaining the patriarchy and therefore not critiquing or being quote unquote sensitive about the ways that our bodies are used. And so it's like this double-edged sword, I guess I would say, that to me, I think it's just a much more deeper context of misogynoir and patriarchy that we just really don't talk about.
No, absolutely. I think that's a very concise summation of, yeah, why that passage stood out to me, the depth in it, and just like just a single image was really striking to me. I mean, even what you just said, the idea that to acknowledge, to reckon with, and certainly to be public about sexual violence experience as a fat Black person, as a fat Black child, is the idea that it's, it's almost like the image in my mind is like, it's like, nigga, your visa was already temporary, like you was already on the margins. And so now you want to get testy, right? Like, because you dare like say, you dare call the thing what it is, right? You dare say like, I faced violence. That was violent, right? It's like, okay, well, you're right. And if you think that's violent, watch this, right? Like, prepare to be no longer on the conditional receiving end of a system like patriarchy, right?
No,
And
I
I think
love
something
that.
that stuck out to me was that, yeah.
Go ahead, go ahead.
Go ahead, go ahead. No, you're good.
No, I was just gonna say that I love that because I think that that's quite literally what I feel like is being assessed, or rather what's being offered in these like in these interactions, even if not with those words exactly, right? Like, of course, I don't think that, every single cis man who is, assaulting black boys in our community is saying like, you're fat, but you're also a boy, so therefore, like you, blah blah blah. That conversation's not typically happening. I don't really see that happening. But what I do think is like, this sort of collective unconscious, if you will, that we have, that we're ascribed to, that we're sort of socialized into, or that's prescribed to us, I will say, I think is forcing us into this understanding that if we are to, it's in some ways particularly, I want to rephrase. I think that there's something very important about making sure that we are considering how fat black boys in particular, especially in the Black South, are being engaged as people who have bodies deemed worthy of being assaulted, but are being socialized under a politic that says that you cannot be committed to the undoing of patriarchy. And so, because your commitment must be to sustaining patriarchy, I can violate your body in this way without this particular understanding that you will go and share that somewhere else with someone else that has a certain level of authority, because your commitment is to upholding patriarchy. And if you then go and say that I've been assaulted, right, then that means you're calling yourself gay, right? That's oftentimes a conflation. That means that you are, wanting to take down the black man, right? All these things that come along with that. And of course, black girls deal with that in a very particular way. But I think that because of this, like this general understanding that black girls and their bodies are supposed to be violated, and also that there's no outright commitment that they're supposed to have to upholding patriarchy, at least in the general like mind of cis men, right? That there's a difference in that relation. There's a difference in what you do and how you do that. And so I think that like there's just something so important about that, because what I'm trying to offer with this imagery, and I just love that you pulled this, is that if that level of assault, be it sexual or otherwise, can fall so crisply on our bodies as people who are understood to be masculine or whatever, then there's a certain level of complete assault or erase or erasure or harm that's happening to the women that we put on pedestals for their service to us because of how we possess them. And I think that that is what I'm really trying to offer with that, is like there's a much deeper relationship that we must, or rather a much deeper analysis we must have about massage noir and fatness, if we're going to really deeply understand just exactly how these structures show up in our lives, and exactly how these structures stand to benefit from our commitment to maintaining patriarchy and anti-fatness for that matter.
Yeah. No, absolutely. What I'm reminded of, I forget which story it is on Hotels, the Jasmine Sullivan album, but there's this
Yes.
one of the little monologues, someone speaking, I presume it's a black woman talking about, one of the things that they say is like, they're basically talking about like, Black men not understanding or accepting Black women as sexual people, as agents of their own desire. And there's this one line where they're like, and we're to blame too, because we're out here telling them, I think the quote is like, we're out here telling them that the pussy is theirs, when in reality it's ours.
Right.
And I think what you just said is a real problematization of that, because that actually isn't the problem. It's it's not like being able to, I'm gonna punch this nigga in the head. I don't know why he's screaming. Give me one sec, I'm sorry.
You're fine.
I'm sorry. I'm gonna try to just use my my sound guard, because I have a feeling he's not gonna stop.
No, guys, dogs got their own brain.
Yeah, it's true. And I really be trying to refuse that core truth. That's like one of my toxic traits. I'm just like, no, shut up. Like, I don't care. What was I saying? I think something that you're really trying to get us to challenge in the book is the idea that recognition is enough alone, right? Like, that recognition somehow is some radical political action in and of itself. So to say like, oh, like, you know, this pussy is mine, good for you, is that going to keep your body, is that going to keep you in possession of your body? No, absolutely not.
Right.
Right? It's as wild as a premise as to say like, you know, if I'm aware of the sexual violence of men, then I'm somehow safer. No. These things are like figured as salvific because the alternative is so unimaginable, or the alternative is so distasteful. A tweet thread yesterday I saw about like, you know, would y'all, like, y'all always talking about like, you know, arming Black women with guns, but like you would all be dead, you know, like you would all be shot.
Right.
So what,
saw that thread.
To circle back, I really appreciate what's happening in the book, because it's not just this like, oh, like, so, you know, oh, like, are you asking me then to, recognize that I see this person as worthy of nothing, and then I'm good. Like, that's my homework, is to just do some, you know, some unconscious shoveling. And it's like, I think the invitation is greater and more troubling, because the invitation is to allow that knowledge to do what it can to you without trying to reroute it. Without trying to reroute it towards like body positivity, without trying to reroute it towards like, you know, some other paradigm of like, oh no, like, you know, the reason we be posting memes about our grannies arm fat, that's because they old. That has nothing to do with fatness or the body. That's because that's my ancestor. And it's like, no, nigga, that's not the case. Like, these things are not, that's not the case. Because look, my grandma's skinny as hell, y'all. My grandma is skinny as hell. I would never post a picture of her on Thanksgiving. If I posted a picture, y'all be like, nice. Nice that you're with family.
Right.
Who catered? Right? You niggas would be in the replies like, who catered, you know? Because that association is so severe.
Right.
So, yeah, that's all to say. Recognition, I think, for me in reading this book is not, that's not gonna cut it. And I think what you're really sort of making clear is like, if recognition is the final frontier, if that's what you think is the only thing you can do, is to acknowledge that like, oh yeah, I guess my proximity to fatness or thinness doesn't form the way I experience the world. Cool. If that's it, then we have a problem. And the problem is more insidious than like ignorance, but it's desire, right? It's like, oh, you know that this shit is set up this way and you are perfectly happy to reproduce it because you want to.
Right. Precisely. No, ooh, please. That is literally like that. I don't even think that there's much else I can add to that. That's precisely it. I think that what those first two chapters in particular, you know, the first one being on body positivity and self-love, the second one being on desire and ugliness and prettiness, what they're really trying to grapple with is exactly what you just named. It's that, like, for some, sure, maybe it is ignorance, but for the most part, and also even for those for whom it is just ignorance, the heart of it is desire, right? It's about what I desire, why I desire, and what I will continue to desire despite how much awareness or knowledge I have, right? So it's really about the limitations of knowledge in so many ways, right? It's like, what does it mean to have knowledge or to be knowledgeable if that has its limits? And what does it mean if its limits are produced by desire and desirability? Or if we take Sexton and Wilderson seriously, and I know that the both of us do, what does it mean if those limitations are produced by the libido economy? And then what comes beyond that, right? Like, what happens next? And I think that that answer looks different for a lot of people. But for me, I'm saying I'm deeply invested in the undoing of these very structures. And I don't mean that just in a theoretical sense. And I don't mean that just in, you know, in talking about that as if it's far away or separate from me, but rather I also mean that to say that in my own life, I'm interested in continuously figuring out what it looks like to understand these structures beyond the theoretical, which means that I'm also always figuring out how I can move closer, or rather how I can move further away from the hegemonic desire that we're socialized into, right? Like, who am I desiring and why? Who am I surrounded by and why? Who am I uplifting and why? Who am I celebrating and why? And, you know, that then goes to, so you're celebrating or you're uplifting your grandma, but then you have to get to that second part of the question, which is, and why? And the answer in that case is because her fatness is positioned as something necessary to be possessed and not something that comes with its own autonomy to where she's able to be celebrated outside of what she can do for you. And so what I'm hoping that those two chapters get to the heart of, and I just, John, like, I adore you because I have been in all of these conversations over the past, I don't know how long it's been, since August, I don't know, about body positivity and self-love. And I feel like they have forced me to stay at the surface of what my critique is, but there's so much in those two chapters, I think, that require you to read with a closer look. And it's supposed to bring you back here, which is to say that, like, what I'm offering and what I'm really trying to get to the heart of is that desire is, you know, the Christians say the love of money is the root of all evil. And I am offering that desire is the root of all evil, whether you love it or not. And that because that is the root of this evil, because so much of our relationship to desire is something that is structurally harmful, how do we move then from our ignorance to gaining knowledge, to then implementing and applying what we know to our actual everyday lives. And I think a lot of us, especially in this academic sphere, I'm not an academic, but I'm around a lot of academic girls, so, you know, whatever. I think a lot of us in this, you know, academic, theorist, scholar sphere really get stuck in that theoretical. We get really stuck in being able to explain all these things. But seldom do I ever witness it being applied to an individual's life. And I'm wanting to walk us from this middle point, right, where we're no longer ignorant, but we're also living in the theoretical, and move us to applying that to our actual lives. Because, yeah, no, I don't think that we undo desire by doing that, right? We don't undo desire unless we undo anti-blackness, and we all know the stakes of that. But I do think that there is, that we don't have to wait for the undoing of anti-blackness or for the end of the world to apply these concepts to our everyday lives. And I think that sometimes we pretend that that's the case.
I love that. Absolutely. You know, I talk a lot about, I think a lot about how something that is so naturalized, if there's no reward for it, you know, and I was thinking about this, and I'm like, I think this is true. I think you actually see this very poignantly when it comes to fat studies and how the academy treats fat scholars. The university is that, oh, this has nothing to do with the reward of producing what I'm, here's what I'm trying to say. Every few years, there's a hot new concept, hot new framework, la, la, la. I think, I wouldn't compare it to the sort of non-thought or hatred towards Black study, but I think it's actually interesting to think about like a traditionally white fat studies. What do people in the field think or say about it? My very cursory impression as someone like is no longer technically in the academy because I'm on leave, but I'm still the girl. I don't think you can say people dislike fat studies without saying dislike fat people. Like, I don't think that would even make sense. As saying, oh, people hate Black studies because they love Black people. No, it has something to do with what you think about Blackness.
Right.
Right. It's not. Absolutely. It's not like, oh, you know, I hate Black studies because, you know, I just, because again, right, like these, even something like Black studies, like you have people using all sorts of different frameworks and approaches, right? Just like in fat studies, right? So it's like, you can't be like, oh, well, I'm a Marxist, so I don't fuck with X. You know, I don't fuck with fat studies. It's like, me thinks this has something to do with how these people are trying to bring us back to desire. Because, right. You know, I feel like walking that line, you know, like you're talking about, like toting that line, that middle ground of, okay, I understand what kind of cataclysmic violence, what kind of cataclysmic action will be necessary to change our relationship to each other. And I'm interested in staying there, even if it's not rewarding to stay there.
Right.
Even if you're punished for staying there. So that's something I'm thinking about. I guess the other way this is working in my head is like, I think when people who are not fat perceive fat people, I think it reminds us that desire is this like wild fight between something we have access to, something like a beauty standard, right? Like, I was born into a world with marble statues. Okay, fine. But that doesn't mean that I'm not actively producing and making meaning, right? It doesn't mean that I am not enlisted and or excited to be a part of a system that reproduces violence against fat people, that re-deifies thinness and beauty, that glamorizes and glorifies dieting and exercise. And so I guess what I'm trying to walk to is this idea of like impossibility, because I think especially like you were saying, right, you're like, I'm not just theorizing here, I'm thinking about how this shows up in my own life. There's a moment in Belly of the Beast where you write something akin to, you know, to not desire fat people is to be fat phobic. It is to be anti-fat. Uh-huh. There's no circumstantial anti-fatness. It's like, well, child, it was Friday and I was tired, so no, right? And because there's no such thing as substantial, just like there's no such thing as accidental anti-blackness, right? I think what it invites me to think of is like just how impossible desiring fatness and fat people is figured for people, mm-hmm. fat people and thin people alike, right? It's just like that as you write in the book, that is how that is the trajectory that diet culture preys upon. This idea of, you know, I want to make a play on the Asada. What's the Asada phrase? We have nothing to lose by our change. You have nothing to lose but your pounds, okay? Right. You ain't got nothing to lose but your pounds, right? So like this progress narrative is the only way. And if you want to go in the opposite direction, or if you want to like challenge the validity of it being a progress narrative, that desire, I feel like, is not registered as your own, right? It's like, it's almost derided as like lunacy, or like, oh, you just doing that shit to be bored, or oh, you just doing that shit, like, oh, you just fucking fat people, you just desiring fat people just. And it's like weird to think that, but what does that say, right?
Right.
Like if one conceives of desiring fat people as something trendy and not a choice, that's deep. Because what you would then be saying is that is, you know, I. It's not that I have ceded control of my desire, but I have looked around and acknowledged that this would take some time and energy, and I don't give a fuck. So you know, good luck.
That is the next.
Right, and like what we just described is not written about as a kind of violent reasoning. Mm-hmm. But how is that not, right? If what I just said swapped out fat with black, or instead of just fatness, we were talking about black fat people, would that not ring weird? You know,
a lot of people would be scared. You know,
thinking, okay. Which I think is what, because, you know, as I'm reading the book, you know, I'm just, you know, thinking about like me talking to this book, like with my younger siblings and things, and like the import for them as young black people to think of this as something that is relevant to how they see the world, regardless of if they're fat or not. Because they're being invited to make a choice that I want them to know is a choice, right? And I feel like that's something you're very thoughtful about in the book. You're not interested in, you're not interested in like giving niggas a pass, but you are interested in like giving Black people the kind of breathing room to ascertain what is actually at stake, what anti-fatness actually means for.
Yes. That there is a choice to be made. And of course, you know, there's an argument to be had, again, theoretical about Black folks not having autonomy and no choice to consent and to make a choice and all of that. But, and as an individual, you do have a choice, right? And you have a right to make
whatever choice it may be.
And I also have the right to say that one of those choices is bullshit, right? And I think
that, like,
we don't want to acknowledge that, but
it's the same thing with the free speech girls. It's like, okay, nobody told you y'all could just say shit without recourse. Like, the recourse is coming. Be as free as you want with them lips, but you will hear from us.
Yeah, like, yeah. Like, girl,
say, call me a nigger,
and I will still bop you in the fucking mouth. You have the right to say.
Yeah, right.
You have the right to beat your ass.
Like, it's that. It's,
yeah.
Like,
I just think that
I think folks want to
live in this space where that's not true, and or that I don't live there.
Yeah, no, dead ass. Like, which I think actually reminds me of this next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is the war on drugs and the war on obesity, and how these dueling wars, or not even dueling, how these complementary simultaneous wars, what they tell us about desire and what we're willing to do to maintain it or to maintain our sense of self, but also I think like very specifically how desire is, how do I put this? What I got from Deshaun's engagement with the war on obesity and the war on drugs is it helped me think about how the state, the nation state, the government that we live under, all these regimes, they have an unparalleled understanding of how desire moves us. And they are the masters of that shit. Such that they can create and enlist you in a war. And you don't feel like you're being enlisted. You feel like you're being invited, right? Like you're being invited to defend America against X. You're being invited to quote unquote become healthy, oppose, you know, X. And you know, like, it's not a secret, but maybe for some people it is, that against is always gonna have something to do with niggas. Like, it was really wild to me. It was something I had never really read about. And so, yeah, like just thinking about these wars simultaneously was really helpful for me. Something else I wanna address, or you know, some dressing I wanna add before I ask you to talk about this, was, I feel like I've talked about this on the podcast, but maybe I haven't. So in Belly of the Beast, Deshaun talks a little bit about Samuel Cartwright, who was this in the early 1800s, was a proto-race scientist, a proto-eugenicist in the plantation economy in Mississippi, Louisiana, and was the sort of pioneer of draptomania, which was this, I saw a really excellent tweet yesterday that someone said, you know, draptomania was not a pseudoscience. These things were never pseudo. right? Just like, right, Deshaun, like the CDC report on obesity, right? That wasn't pseudo. We might say it's pseudo now because it's been uncovered as a fallacy, but in process, these things are known. It's these science. Things have a certain utility. It's science, right? It's fucking science. Just like, you know, 3 months ago, Fauci had an idea of science that is no longer science now, right? Now we can just spit loogies into each other's mouths, you know, 2 inches apart, and we're safe because science. So you know, these things weren't pseudo. They serve a utility. They were science, and they disciplined enslaved Black people. It was about disciplining slaves. It was about maintaining control of the plantation. That's why Samuel Cartwright became so successful as a physician, as a researcher, because he offered that to the plantation economy. It just so happens that one of my ancestors, my great-great-great-grandfather, Richard, was owned by Samuel Cartwright's widow in Natchez. Put it like this. My ancestor's owner would be so sad if he heard us talking about his precious science as pseudo. So in honor of him, I'm going to remind us there was nothing fake about it, right? Mm-hmm. He was a genius of his time in the same way that the CDC, you know, all them CDC scientists, I'm sure are not hungry right now.
Right.
They're good, right? Yep. Like they didn't face retribution. They weren't ostracized. And it was because their science acted on certain people in a certain way. It disciplined certain people in a certain way. And then I feel like we've talked a lot about drugs on the podcast with different folks, with Gilberto, with Raw. You know, I come from a family of addiction, so I'm always thinking about, you know, like this unsettling of agency, you know, which again, right, it's not to I mean, I think a particular responsibility as like a child of an addict to be like, yeah, there's some things that niggas are responsible for. There's something like a choice. And there's also like, at least for me, some benefit to understanding what was the economy that they were making these choices in? Like what was conditioning them? What, you know what, right, I mean? Yeah, so I would really love to just hear like what, like was this something that came naturally to you? Like, had you been thinking about the war on drugs in tandem, or how did you sort of arrive to this engagement?
Yes, oh, I love this. So essentially, literally like years ago, maybe in 2017, 2018, I don't know, it was years ago. I wrote a thread on Twitter. You know, I used to do so many threads on Twitter. And there was this thread and I was like, you know, similar to the war on drugs, you know, the US government, the media, and scientists, you know, built this industry as a way to criminalize, ostracize, et cetera, fat people, talking about the war on obesity. And that was, I did a lot of research afterwards and I was like, you know, no one has ever made this connection before. I've never seen this written anywhere else. And for me, it just felt so obvious, but also so important. I was like, you know, like these are two wars that are genocides that are happening at the same time. Like, you know, folks credit the 80s as the crack epidemic, but the crack epidemic never stopped, right? Like that wasn't a thing that was like, oh, 1980 starts, 1989 it stops. Like that's not how that worked. So it was like in the same time that Clinton and Bush were creating the conditions for an industry that would be built on anti-fat science, this crack epidemic was still ravaging Black communities. And I think it's something that's so important about the ways that this connection is never necessarily made explicit, but that these are two of the biggest, these are two of the biggest sort of projects from the past six presidents. These are their sole focus. Right, exactly, right? Like we've had Democrat and Republican presidents, and this has still been, you know, this war on drugs and this war on obesity have still been two of the biggest projects taken up by all of them. And, you know, for me, it was like, there's something here, something important about pointing out the ways that media, science, and government have actively worked together to construct these wars on Black people to build entire industries that they can profit from, right? Like, so if there is a war on obesity, we know that that war is also on the Black, right? And we know that that starts at the construction of the BMI as a thing that determines the general health, quote unquote, of our bodies. And in that same vein, we're witnessing all of the legislation that's happening to criminalize Black folks and marijuana, right? We know that under Clinton came in campaigning on being, you know, against the criminalization of marijuana. And then he gets in office and he realizes that even though majority of Americans are also in favor of decriminalizing marijuana, that he has to get the backing of his Republican counterparts. And so now all of a sudden he's also criminalizing marijuana and helping to build one of the largest industries in the world on the backs of criminalizing Black people that we called the prison industrial complex, right? And so, like, or mass incarceration, more specifically. And in that same time frame, right, this is why I wrote this in chapter four. And I wrote chapter four and then wrote chapter five for this reason, because I want people to understand this as a continuation. In this time frame, the late 90s, early 2000s, when we have our Clinton and Bush administrations happening, and we're seeing, like, this growth spurt in this era of mass incarceration. You have folks in Chicago. This is just one of the documented places, but it's happened all around the country. You have prosecutors and judges in Chicago who are playing games, like literal courtroom games, to determine how many fat folks they can lock up for marijuana possession. A very literal example of the ways that the war on drugs and the war on obesity have been complementary to one another to target fat Black folks in particular, and to acknowledge the fact that more Black folks than not are understood as fat because of the way that the BMI is structured. And so, like, there's just such a huge relationship between the two. And what I wanted to do with that chapter five, was be like, you know, there's a big relationship here, but even if you don't see a relationship here, you should, but even if you don't, what you have to acknowledge is that the very foundation, the genesis of both of these wars are documented, like, processes where these three different entities, government, science, and media, stand to benefit from our subjugation. And for me, that's the only similarity that has to be there for me to care. I don't care if they weren't connected at all. Like, if that was the only thing that was true about these two projects, I would be like, yep, gotta throw this in there. But the fact that it's also much deeper than that is, I think, just something so important.
I'm happy that you said it like that, because I was making fun earlier about folks who are into, like, this abstract relation of, like, oh, like, what happens if we think intimately about our assholes in the ocean, right? Like, that is something else. Like, y'all need God, right? Another extreme is, I think, a kind of, what do I want to say? I would say the other extreme is a version of, without some kind of proving of causation or proving of, well, what came first, the chicken or the egg? Mm-hmm. Which for niggas is so silly sometimes, I think, because these things, I mean, the word you almost use, right, are like coterminous. Like, these things are not only happening at the same time, but they are to do with niggas, which means that they are not bound by time in the same way, you know?
Right.
It's not, you know, it's not a matter of like sequential order. It's a matter of like, oh, is this nigga shit? Cool. So what we know for sure is that whatever laws we would generally follow, not gonna follow, right? Like, right. If you wanna make sense of the example you used, if you wanna make sense of quote unquote legal sense, if you wanna make legal sense of Cook County prosecutors playing a game that they refer to as niggers by the pound, wherein they were tallying up the weight of Black people they successfully prosecuted and sent to prison.
Right.
If you want to make legal sense of that, or sense, common sense of that, without thinking, like you said, intimately about how, what makes this person worthy of prosecution, incarceration, is a amalgamation of their fatness and their Blackness.
Right.
Like, that's not, that's very clear.
Right.
I feel like that's not even an argument. And so I really like the way you said it. yeah, that I'd never, again, I'd never heard of that. I mean, I believed it because it was Chicago. I was like, yeah, that's Cook County. That's Cook County. I mean, just the depraved and put it like this, the thoughtfulness that goes behind these people's.
Yes.
The things that the things that they create to derive pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really struck by like that like fucking word I kept thinking of was like accumulation, because it's like, I don't know, there was just something really weird to me about, here's what I want to say. There was something weird to me about how the game wasn't who can lock up the most niggers.
Mm-hmm.
Why wasn't it that? You know?
Right.
That's kind of weird, right? Which doesn't necessarily mean then that fatness or Black fatness displaces the these defendants' Blackness, right? No. This is just an example of how, like, the kind of pleasure that these prosecutors got from it was kind of different.
Yes.
Right? It was a special sauce there. And I don't think we need to have the 500-word treatise on what the special sauce is to be like, that's some special sauce. It's like there's something ineffable about like the meme of a Black woman's arm fat. There's something there that people want to derive pleasure from. And it's completely almost pre-conscious. It's just like, of course I'm tallying the weight of these niggers as I prosecute them and send them to prison.
And they would do so in a way, like, they would trump up charges.
Right. This isn't like, oh well, you know, this is a like, it's a part of the thing.
Right. Like, these people are not people who, you know, were out being serial killers, they were people who were caught with a blunt in hand and suddenly were going to prison for the same amount of time that somebody who was a serial killer was going to prison for, simply because they were fat and black. And it was fun. It was exciting. Who can get to 4,000 pounds sooner?
Yeah.
And there was no reward.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I think is also just so insidious. There was no specific award for this. It was just, we're just going to do it because we can, because it's fun, because it's exciting. That's so wild to me. And I think what you're saying,
it just reminds me of how you were talking. It reminds me of how you were talking about, you know, like the fat black boy child's body, right? As like, as quote unquote, deserving and inviting of this specific order of violence, partly because socially everyone has agreed that they're not going to do anything about it, you know, that they'll co-sign it. And so I can also imagine a public defender, LOL, or just like even a legal advocacy org being like, huh, this is really weird. All these fat black people are like going to prison for 10 years on a blunt, but that's crazy, huh? Well, what do y'all want to watch?
Right, right. And also now it's justified because, hey, you got Clinton in office who's racking up these three strikes rules, you know, incarcerations, right? Then you get Bush in office and he's the start in so many ways of this whole obesity epidemic.
Yeah.
Right. So like, why do we need to change anything? We have on the federal level people who are in support of this type of behavior.
Right. 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 It's like, so in Cook County, they're counting niggas by the pound. At the White House, they're counting niggas by the cell. Cool, cool.
And then going to our schools and counting niggas by the pound. Right? Like that, like it's justifiable when you have it like that.
Such that niggas are so hungry that if I end up in prison, it's probably because I beat the shit out of my lunch lady because she gave me an apple.
And now I'm going to go back because there I know I can get three free meals.
I was about to say, like, my mom serves lunch at the school that she works at, and, like, she be sending me pictures. And I'm like, what the fuck is that?
No, literally, what?
And it's not just like, oh, you know, it's a low-fat dressing. Nah, G. I'd be looking at these pictures, and I'm like, this is what those, like, straight couples would serve each other if, like, they were pranking each other on YouTube for a reaction.
Right.
Like, this is a clear sign of not just neglect, but, like, there's a pleasure to be had here. And right. I really do think that, right? We don't want to say that Michelle Obama derives pleasure from making niggas get up and exercise. She does. She does. And it's really weird that that's not thought of as like a perverse thing, right? That, well, you know, we couldn't give you niggas healthcare, but hey, I'm gonna come to your public school and watch you do jumping jacks for 30 minutes.
I'm gonna have Beyonce recreate her, you know, most popular songs and make it about kids working out. Now we got, you know, Disney Channel characters having whole ass summer games to promote 60 minutes of exercise. We're just like, it's just so insidious the way that, like, all of it just relates back to punishment of our bodies to diet as an industry. And hell yeah, Michelle got enjoyment out of that. She loved that shit. I mean, shit, she wrote about it in her kids and her books. Like, that's her jush. You know, that's what gets her up. And that's why I'm like, y'all think Barack is the only weirdo?
It's La Familia.
Very much. It's very much a family affair. Like, it's not giving for me. And it's no shade.
Really is a whole mess. It's a whole mess, yo. You know, like I'm just thinking of how in the wake, Christina Sharpe's book In the Wake, there's this moment where she's talking about this like week where Barack Obama goes to Sandy Hook, Newtown. Is that Sandy Hook was in Newtown? Yeah, he goes to Sandy Hook and he does a speech where he's like, you know, not one more child should die from gun violence.
Right.
He uses those words, not one more.
Yeah.
Same week or same month, he ends up actually in Chicago, right? And he's talking about gun violence and he says, you know, we won't be able to save everyone.
I remember reading that in her book and I remember hearing him say that as well.
And like that's, and niggas will applaud that. Niggas will say, you right, nigga, we won't. Huh?
Yeah.
Like this man is giving you the 411 on how the policy, the vision is for some of you niggas to die terrible deaths. And our acculturated response is, hell yeah.
Right. I mean, Obama sat in our faces
and
called us thugs and degenerates.
And we said, yes, daddy.
Yes.
Yes, right. Bend me over the knee.
Literally.
Yeah.
Offer him to put on a beige suit, and now he becomes a meme of being somebody's light-skinned-ass, sexy-ass uncle. Like, hello?
And you know what? I'm like, maybe if we would have started with y'all desiring your light-skinned uncles at the beginning of the election, we would have had a different... But again, it goes back to desire. It goes back to desire, you know?
Everything like, does.
To desire punishment, to desire being the blackface head of state, on a very intimate level, to desire being a parent, an abusive parent, to desire being a drill sergeant, mom.
Yeah.
Okay.
Everything goes back to desire. I could talk about desire all day because I really don't think people understand exactly just how far-reaching it is. Like I'm in the middle of writing an essay right now that's supposed to be due tomorrow. And I'm writing about, you know, our desire to heal, but not because we see it as something that makes us better, but rather because there's a social currency in positioning yourself as healed in the world. But what does that look like for Black people who are always having to grieve because we're always living in a state of grief and pain and sorrow? That's a different conversation, but...
It's like, you know, you play an operation on yourself with stitches while the fucking blade is still in your fucking... It's like, okay, at some point you're going to have to acknowledge that you look crazy. Like, you look really wild. This doesn't make sense. This is not going to end how you purportedly wanted to.
It's not clicking.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I know we're running up against time, but, you know, before I let you go, there's one line that I am obsessed with, and I think over time it will become clear to me why I'm obsessed with it, but that'll be a long process that I'll keep you updated on. It's a line from I forget what chapter it is actually.
Cool.
Yeah, I used page instead of I think so. It's pretty. With
chapter two.
I think you write about insecurity in a way that I haven't experienced before. I also am interested in the word itself and just its own etymology, like its relationship to security. But the line is, quote, insecurities are not a personal indictment. They are an indictment of the world, end quote. And I think something you offer in that chapter is like, it's an like this invitation to embrace or become more aware or intimate, to see your insecurity for what it is, yeah, as an indictment of the world, and to allow that indictment of the world that you have actually produced. Like, I think that's what was so interesting to me about it, is it's like, whoa, like, so you're telling me that, like, my mind has, so rather than thinking of it, an insecurity as like some evil, dirty thing that I have allowed to fester or that I have birthed through my own moral deficit, whether it's like I'm a jealous person, I'm a vain person, whatever. Rather than thinking of an insecurity as that, to think of it as like this, almost this gift that you accidentally made for yourself, you know? Mm-hmm. Like this really sharp indictment of the world that's like screaming at you, like, hey, something's not right here. Like that you haven't even maybe consciously done anything to make. Like, it's just kind of like easy bake oven, that ass. Like, it's just there now. Because you've moved through the world and you've been acted on by the world and it's acted mm-hmm. against you. And like, it's just like a fucking world, just like, hey. I just thought it was really interesting to think like, okay, what is a different way to relate to that thing? If you're not trying to kill it, if you're not trying to exorcise it, if you're not trying to send it to hell, what other relationships could you have to it? I'd love if, as we mosey on out, if just like the way I have it here is like, which I guess is really connected to what we just said about the Wawa, this idea of insecurity is not being a personal indictment, but being an indictment of the world. Are there ways that you see niggas in the future using this where you're like, actually, nigga, that's not what I meant? Are there ways where you're like, oh, like, I never thought about it like that. Like, I'm really excited to see how that sort of grows. And then, you know, maybe if it's not insecurity, maybe there's another concept that you've sort of, now that you've launched it into outer space and people are engaging it, you're kind of really excited by what folks are excited or terrified by what niggas are doing with it.
Yeah. So this is one of the most engaged parts of the book, actually. This chapter on desire and desirability is one of the most engaged chapters of the entire book, and it horrifies me because I don't know that people, I fear that people are thinking of it as an alternative to Pretty Privilege. And I have major critiques of the word alternative because I think that it insinuates or implies that the thing that needs an alternative is something that is valid, something that has value. And I don't see Pretty Privilege as something that is that. And so my concern is that people just replace that term with desire or desire capital, but apply the same logics to it. And I've seen that a little bit, and I've been like, girl, that's not what I wrote, but okay. but in terms of insecurity, I very seldom say that I'm like proud of coming up with the concept, but this is something that I'm very proud of because I think that so many of us move with a lot of insecurity, and we have those insecurities because we're taught that the things that are wrong with us and our bodies are our fault, right? That the onus is on us, the blame is on us for having quote-unquote faults, for having quote-unquote imperfections. And what I am offering with this framing of insecurity is that what if not this cliche, you know, idea of, you know, I'm perfectly imperfect for you, or my imperfections are like, not that cliche Hallmark card bullshit. Not that bullshit. But like offering something that is like, what if these insecurities that you're experiencing are only things you understand as things worthy of being insecure about because of anti-blackness, right? What if desire leads us to believing that these parts of ourselves are not worth feeling confident in, right? Or that confidence is scarce because of desire. And what does that look like, right? Like, what does it mean then to live with that as your politic? And so what I'm offering is like, I don't want to recreate moments wherein people are allowing their insecurities to take lead in their politic, right? I think we've witnessed what that looks like, where people are, they move in a very particular way, where there's something that they feel is justified by allowing, you know, the fact that they feel embarrassed by their stomachs, for example, to be the thing that determines their politic. And it's like, babes, I'm so sorry, but our individual experiences do not determine the way that the rest of the world functions. And while our lived experience does add to data, it does not make up data by itself. And so it's like, I don't want us to have a whole world full of people who are like, well, today I woke up feeling insecure about my big toe, so I'm gonna, you know, let that be the thing that determines my politic. Like, that's not what I'm wanting. But it is to say, like, it's worth leaning into that insecurity to have a deeper conversation with yourself about where it comes from and why, right? Like, what is it about this insecurity that, or about this feature, this thing that makes me insecure? And is it more deeply related to something else? And if it is, how can I adjust? How can I adjust my relationship to this thing where I stop understanding myself as the cause for it, and therefore blaming myself when I fail on the days where I wake up and no longer feel happy about this thing or confident in this thing, and instead place the onus on the very structure that allows for this to be something that is an insecurity? I think it's so important. And for me, it helped me. I don't think people understand what it feels like to be considered to be a thought leader or a leading scholar in something, and therefore being placed on a pedestal and not really having room to be honest about your relationship with your body. And so for this, for me, it was like, this provides me the framework that's necessary to offer myself grace when the rest of the world will not. When I wake up on certain days and I'm like, I'm not feeling it today, right? Like, this body of mine is something I don't feel confident in. I don't feel happy about it. And not feel like I've failed myself and all these thousands of people who believe me to be, you know, their wet nurse, their savior, their, you know, their person to look up to. Because I woke up today saying, my fatness is not something that I'm feeling confident about today. And I think that that's an important framework to apply to everything that we feel insecure about, because again, everything leads back to desire. always and already. And so, yeah, it was important for me to have this framework for myself, but also for other people who were lying to themselves about being insecure. I think that we sit in spaces, especially in Black queer spaces, where everyone calls you jealous or whatever, and you're like, I'm not jealous, I'm not insecure, I'm blah, blah, blah. And now you have to put up this whole facade and this performance about being happy and secure and confident about where you're at. And it's like, girl, no, I'm not. And what does it mean for jealousy to be valid? And what does it mean for insecurity to be valid? And what does it mean for, not being confident to be valid when you're living amongst people who exist in bodies, with skin complexions, with certain abilities that you don't have, in a world that rewards people with those abilities that you don't have? How can you sit in somebody's face all day long and tell them that everything about who they are is death, leads them to death, it's harmful, it's violent, it's wrong, it's unrighteous, right? It's greedy, it's dirty, all of the things. And then expect them to just not be insecure or not be jealous or not be unhappy with where they are all the time. To me, that just feels impossible. And when I realized that, I realized that it also feels like it's a request for capital U ugly people to position ourselves as, or position ourselves in a way that requires us to perform for pretty, beautiful, desirable people, and their need to hold power over us while also not acknowledging the ways that they have access to particular things that we don't. And so that's what leads to that concept. And then, anything short, anything that doesn't, any analysis that doesn't come back to that for me when using my understanding of insecurity is something that I cringe at, because I'm like, I didn't say that. But I am very excited about the thoughts that might come from this that will lead to a deeper analysis that I hadn't considered. I'm looking forward to that completely, because I know that it's out there.
No, it absolutely is. Thank you. That was very enlightening. I'm so happy I asked that question. The word I was thinking about as you were speaking was unbearable. And I like the idea of, as you said, like insecurity being a way to say, there's something unbearable about my being right now, and I'm not interested in bearing it by myself. So here you go. Which might be of some use to many people, but for, like you said, capital U ugly people who are provisionally allowed to be only when they are capital R resilient, capital C confident, not doing that is actually, that doesn't seem like a simple recognition to me. It does. And maybe it's not revolutionary, but it certainly seems antagonistic, right? To say, you hold it here, right? Or not even you hold it, but I am not going to fucking like die with this boulder on my back.
I
Don't
don't
feel
care who
like
holds it, it
enough.
won't be me.
Won't be me. Hot potato, Yeah. Yeah, which, like I'm just thinking, and I'll stop here. It's like it's about time for hot potato, y'all. Like on many for hot potato. Like, at the BLM march, it's hot potato. It's not time for
No,
petition.
not
It's
so.
not time for someone needs to throw a potato right now. And that bitch needs to be hot. Take it as you will. That shit needs to be piping hot.
No, for real. Because we're dying.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, friend. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for my pleasure. My pleasure. I'm sure it will be the first of many. Yeah, this was lovely. Are there upcoming things that folks should know about, or do you want to, like, if there's anything you'd like to pitch or remind folks who are listening to engage? I know sometimes it's like, no, I actually don't put my Twitter. Niggas should leave me alone. But if there are other things, feel free to use this time to lift stuff up.
I mean, no, you can always plug my socials. At this point, my socials are not mine. So,
yeah, right.
Enjoy. But in terms of, like, upcoming things, of course, also follow me on socials. Helps people to be aware of what I have coming up. And I always have a lot of different events happening, different engagements and things like that, that I'd love to have people at, that I love to see people at. So follow me on there always works. But there are a few different things that I'm working on that I want folks to keep a lookout for. Things like an anthology I'll be part of, a Fat Studies anthology I'll be part of, and an anthology on Black disabled relations, or on disabled relationships, that I will be co-editing. I'm very excited about. Just a lot of, you know, great writing things happening that I think people should stay tuned for.
Lit. Well, Tayshawn, writer, editor, extraordinaire. Thank you for spending some time with us. And we will see y'all on the other side of. You know what? Fuck that. So at the very beginning of this podcast, my little tagline was like, I'll see you on the other side of something better, which I started the podcast, like, I guess 3 years ago. And it sounds, that coming out of my mouth sounds so weird now. It's just funny, you know, like, I kind of like it because it sounds cute. Yeah. I just don't believe it no more.
No, that's
I gotta
real.
Come up with something I believe that sounds that cute. Because all I can muster now is I'll see you niggas later.
I'll see you at some
point. Okay. See, I don't know if something better exists, but later will. I know later's right. Coming.
Right.
I'll see you niggas.